We ended last time looking at some examples of C.K. Blandin's practice of paternalism, and let's begin now by looking at still another sample of that. Although Blandin was never one to regularly attend concerts or the symphony, he liked listening to loud classical music, particularly while reading his Sunday newspapers. He also had a strong affinity for band music, and therein lie another direct community involvement. In the 1930s, he actively supported the Grand Rapids High School Band, aiding in the acquisition of instruments, obtaining the services of a professional director, and furnishing the capes and caps that originally served as uniforms. With Blandin's backing, the organization not only gave frequent concerts in town and at the mill grounds, but also performed occasionally in the Twin Cities. In 1939, Blandin paid the major share to equip the 55-member band with orange and black military-style uniforms. The next year, the band made Blandin an honorary member and presented him with a gold watch charm as a memento of his support. In Blandin's mind, his most important function in Grand Rapids was that of operating and ensuring the continued existence of the town's most important industry. As he told Rossman in 1939, "I am always on the alert to look into anything that would be a protection to the future of the paper company and the community." Blandin was very much aware of the altruistic efforts of his old friend Dan Gunn and of the many other early Grand Rapids businessmen who had sought a paper mill for the town. That understanding was reflected in a letter to Frank King in which Blandin referred to his company as more of a community ownership than a personal one. Blandin considered himself a progressive. The typical Minnesota progressive was a middle-class, thoughtful, urban, although often of small-town origin, knowledgeable, action-oriented person who strongly believed, as did Blandin when he wrote in 1939, that there is no question but what business has failed in many respects concerning the social and economic needs of the state and the nation. Like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, Blandin believed that the monetary resources engendered by industry should be used to promote social good. He didn't wish to amass great personal wealth, and he consistently reinvested company profits into the mill operation. Although his own wealth on paper was considerable, he lived fairly simply, always remaining conscious of the needs and rights of society. As 1940 began, with the idea that a policy that is for the upbuilding of Grand Rapids and Itasca County is both timely and desirable, Blandin began to look for ways to provide stronger and more direct support. Also, 1940 was a year that called for introspection about the future on the part of Charles Blandin. Unbeknownst to any but close family members, Jenny Blandin was suffering from cancer. Her condition worsened rapidly after she slipped and fell on an icy St. Paul street while attempting to board a streetcar. She died in January of 1940. Even though she and Charles had not shared much of their lives during their last years together, without her, Blandin's lifestyle changed considerably. He gave up their rented home and moved into the St. Paul Athletic Club. Although he kept offices of the Blandin Paper Company in the First National Bank building in St. Paul, his association with Grand Rapids became more meaningful than ever, and he began to spend more time in his northern home. With the loss of his wife fresh in mind and another birthday imminent, Blandin was conscious of the need to begin preparing for the future. The idea that most intrigued Blandin was that of the possibility of establishing a foundation during his own lifetime. He had always thought that that would take place in the future and would be part of his legacy, but now it is appealing to him of thinking about getting it undergoing. In March of 1940, he discussed the matter with his good friend, Grand Rapids Herald Review publisher and owner Lawrence Rossman, and Blandin was particularly aware that after the long years of economic difficulty, a foundation organized at once would have very little money available until the manufacturing of paper again resulted in steady profits. Blunden was ambivalent as to the best course of action. But Rossman mulled over this conversation, jotted down his thoughts, and sent them to Blunden in St. Paul. He fully supported the idea of a foundation, describing it as an undertaking so important and so advanced in idealism that every effort should be made to establish it. He did also believe that the top priority should continue to be to ensure the operation of the mill as a permanent and progressive institution, but while keeping that factor firmly in mind, Rossman thought the imminent establishment of a foundation to be sound, and he encouraged Blunden to oversee the project. Rossman said, "Nothing will be gained, and much might be lost by waiting until you are no longer able to direct and influence this undertaking." Recognizing that available funds would be limited for some time, Rossman suggested that by beginning as soon as possible, Blunden could show the trustees what he wanted to accomplish. And Rossman emphasized, "I feel that you would get great satisfaction and happiness in seeing the foundation established. That pleasure, which would be so great to you, should not be delayed to times in which you may not enjoy it." That kept Blunden's interest going, and he decided to investigate further the possible creation of a foundation that would bear his name. Because all but a few token shares of company stock were in his name, Blunden had considerable flexibility to translate his wishes into reality. Blunden turned to his close personal friend, his oldest and most trusted advisor, William H. Oppenheimer. I just want to interject at this point. In later decades, the idea became prevalent among the managers and officers of the mill that it was Oppenheimer who had come up with the idea for the foundation, and that he was thinking in terms of possible tax breaks that it could mean for the company. Well, as we just have seen, that isn't the case. He wasn't involved at all in the early discussions. Those were between Rossman and Blunden. And it was Blunden's very sincere altruism and his very sincere desire to do more for the community that had brought about the idea of the foundation. At any rate, Oppenheimer was a prominent St. Paul attorney who specialized in business and corporate law, was well known for his keen business sense, for his flair for reading balance sheets and operating figures, and for his knowledge of tax laws. Blunden and Oppenheimer had begun their long association when the attorney served as legal counsel for the Dispatch Printing Company. At that time, Oppenheimer handled the legal work for the purchase of the Itasca Paper Company. He then continued his association as attorney for the mill during Blunden's career as a paper manufacturer. Blunden called on Oppenheimer at many crucial times, and when necessary, the lawyer traveled to Grand Rapids to attend to legal matters involving local affairs. Oppenheimer was a shrewd and strong-willed individual. He handled legal affairs for some of the Twin Cities' major corporate accounts, including Brown and Bigelow and the St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company. He moved in the top social and business circles in St. Paul, and he was active in many civic and charitable organizations. Oppenheimer found the self-made, idea-oriented Charles Blunden both refreshing and challenging. The lawyer easily won Blunden's full respect as one of the very few people whose advice and counsel he readily and consistently accepted. On occasion, when Oppenheimer felt strongly enough about an issue, he even told Blunden what decision must be made. The attorney, along with mill manager C.K. Andrews, was one of the key figures deserving credit for substantial aid to Blunden in building his successful career. At the time Blunden began thinking about its foundation, Oppenheimer was undertaking a thoroughgoing reorganization of the corporate affairs of the paper mill and Blunden's other companies. At the same time, due to the death of Jenny, Oppenheimer was also involved in doing a thorough reorganization of Blunden's will. While those factors were going on, Blandon and Rossman's conversation continued, and another was also taken into those plans, and that was company secretary Chris Shacker. It was Shacker who took news of Blandon's thinking down to Oppenheimer. Blandon had given him a number of things to discuss with him, and what Blandon wanted to know, well, was this whole idea going to work? Was it feasible? Could it be done? And he had some really big questions. For example, he was wondering in the beginning, could a foundation established now actually own the paper mill, and could the paper mill then become a tax-free operating entity? Well, that idea wasn't going to go anywhere, but there were lots of others, too. Blandon did want the foundation, if it would come about imminently, to be very carefully linked to the paper company. After Oppenheimer had been informed of all this thought and adjusted himself to this radical new departure, Blandon and Oppenheimer met on a number of occasions to discuss the possibilities more fully. And as he listened, Blandon decided indeed to proceed at once with the foundation. And Oppenheimer was now given the task of preparing articles of incorporation for Blandon's review. The articles were prepared. Blandon met with Oppenheimer once again, and they discussed a few revisions. And in November of 1940, Blandon put his signature on those articles, initiating the Charles K. Blandon Foundation. So the foundation is underway. Who can even think of Grand Rapids today without thinking of the Blandon Foundation? What an enormous, enormous impact Blandon's decision was going to have on future generations. Next time, let's begin by analyzing those articles of incorporation and see exactly what it was that Blandon hoped to accomplish through the auspices of his new foundation.